This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we decode your cold remedies, you know, the tea, the zinc, the vitamin C, to see if there's really any science backing them up. But first, when New Horizons whizzed past Pluto last summer, it sent back wonderful pictures of the planet, or the dwarf planet, as you wish. Remember that cold, icy heart that stretched across the Plutonian surface? Beautiful stuff. But those pictures were only the beginning of a huge trove of data trickling through space back to Earth. We only received the last of that data a month ago and more than a year after the flyby happened. And this week, scientists announced that something strange may be lurking under that icy heart. Sophie Bushwick is here to talk about that and other selected short subjects in science. She's senior editor at Popular Science here in New York. Welcome back, Sophie.
Thanks.
Something strange in the neighborhood going on there?
In Pluto? Yeah, it's really interesting. So the whole western part of the heart is this area called Sputnik Planitia. It's this enormous basin formed from an impact that then filled up with ice. And researchers have realized that since its formation, it's moved about 750 miles away from its original location. And it's moved over towards to align with the tidal axis of Pluto. This is the point where the pull from Pluto's largest moon is strongest. It's been dragged over there by this force, and it's also, as it moved, dragged the whole crust of Pluto with it. So Pluto's almost rolled over.
Wow.
And they think that one of the things that facilitated this movement was the existence of a subsurface ocean.
There's an underwater ocean.
Yeah, under the crust, there's like a slushy, liquidy ocean, which is really surprising because Pluto shouldn't be warm enough to support an ocean like that.
Exactly. So then it must be warm enough, right?
Yeah,
something
it must
going
be.
On under there to keep it melted?
Yeah.
Something, who knows?
Something that's going to give them a lot more to delve into. That makes them happy to have the New Horizons data.
And yeah, who thought when they did this, when they launched this probe, you know, to Pluto, we'd find all this kind of stuff?
It's really amazing because they found this by looking at fault lines on the surface. The fault lines, like cracks in the surface ice, those were the things that indicated to them that the Sputnik Planitia area had moved. And it also suggests that what they think happened is in order for it to move, it probably was because it's heavier there than the rest of the surface. That's why that heavy area got gravitationally drawn to the tidal axis. So that could be because when it formed a basin, early in its formation, it was a basin, the ocean beneath the surface pushed up into a bulge underneath that basin because there was less weight on top of it there, and that bulge increased the weight in the area and dragged it over.
Wow. There's so much stuff coming back from there. Great photos, all this data.
Mm-hmm. It's really exciting.
We have to look at that planet. Minor planet.
Dwarf planet?
Okay.
There's always going to be someone who will fight you on the name.
That's true. All right, well, let's move on to the next topic. We've talked a lot about the gene editing technique CRISPR on the show and how it might be used in the future to edit human cells. And now it looks like that time is upon us already with a clinical trial in China on a human.
That's right. Chinese researchers took the cells of the immune system of one patient who had lung cancer that had spread through the body. They took the immune cells and then they used CRISPR to genetically modify them to cut out a certain kind of protein that sort of slows down the immune system and was allowing the cancer to spread. And then once they had this cell, they cultured it to make lots of copies and put it back in the patient's body. And they felt that it was a really promising technique, and so they've moved on to a clinical trial, a larger trial.
And, of course, everybody's going to wonder, hey, how soon is this available?
Oh, my God, yeah. Probably not for a while. And, I mean, some researchers have even pointed out that this isn't the best way to treat this type of cancer, that there are other treatments that could be more efficient. But the thing about the trial is what it'll show them is, are there side effects? So is there a downside to using this treatment in the human body is one of the things it'll investigate.
Will it also spur other people or other countries to try to do this now that China has opened the door?
I certainly think it'll spur American researchers. I think that Chinese researchers do tend to be more forward in, you know, using CRISPR with humans. But I think that this could set off more of a competition between American and Chinese researchers to use CRISPR.
Let's move on to this other interesting story, and that's President-elect Trump. He says he wants to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. But now it looks like he and the federal government might face legal action if they do so, and from an unusual plaintiff.
That's right. A group of about 20 children has gained the right to sue the federal government over climate change. They say that because the federal government hasn't taken enough steps to reduce the impact of climate change, that these kids and their children are going to be the ones who bear the brunt of, you know, all the effects of climate change, more severe storms, more wildfires, more droughts, a lot of problems. And they're saying, well, this is impeding on our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And they wanted to bring this to court, but the fossil fuel industry and the federal government itself filed a motion to dismiss the case. And what happened most recently is a judge in Oregon said, you can't dismiss the case. It's going to court.
Wow, that'd be interesting to keep track of what's going on there.
Absolutely.
And our last story is about bird poop. That might be a good thing for the climate.
Yeah, bird poop is actually good for the Canadian Arctic. Researchers noticed that every summer there was a spike in ammonia levels, and that's when the birds are coming to the Canadian Arctic. That's when they migrate there. And so it's their poop that's causing this ammonia spike. And the ammonia actually helps combine with other materials, and it seeds clouds in the air. So it creates these low-lying clouds, encourages them to form, and the clouds reflect sunlight, which actually causes a cooling effect.
Wow. Who would ever thought?
I definitely wouldn't have.
You know, it must be happening on great scale here in New York with all the pigeons.
Who knew bird poop was a good thing?
That's it. Hey, that's it. The Sophie Bushwick, a senior editor at Popular Science here in New York. Always good to have you. Thanks for joining us. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. In the days just after the presidential election, if you search the words final election results on Google News, the top result was an article from a dubious website that claimed wrongly that Donald Trump had won the popular vote. And of course, it's not an isolated incident. Over the course of the campaign, false articles spread like wildfire over social networks like Facebook, spreading both fake statistics and accounts of events that had never happened. In fact, an analysis of BuzzFeed News found that in the final 3 months of the election season, fake news stories on Facebook outperformed top real news stories published by news providers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NBC News. Both Google and Facebook have said that they will put measures in designed to slow the spread of fake news. But is that enough? Joining me now is Slate's Will Oremus. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Good to be here.
So tell us about some people tag the recent rise in fake news to something that sounds like a good thing. How could this be a good thing?
That it's a good thing that we're having more fake news. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has tried to defend the company against a lot of the criticism it's been getting in the wake of the election from people saying that people were misinformed, that voters got the wrong information. You had fake news stories that, like the one you mentioned, and actually the fake news stories, according to several data analyses, skewed heavily pro-Trump. And so you had stories about the Pope endorsing Trump, Denzel Washington endorsing Trump, Hillary Clinton being indicted. But what Mark Zuckerberg said is, look, the vast majority of content on Facebook is authentic. We do have mechanisms in place for people to flag fake news. And his perspective was that, you know, really this is a distraction from the fact that what Facebook has done is to have opened up the media to a much wider array of voices than ever before. So he was trying to sort of spin this as a good thing. I don't think a lot of people bought that. But if you are looking for a silver lining here, it could be the fact that companies like Facebook and Google do have the power to change this if they want to. It's not an easy problem. I mean, it's not always easy to draw the line between what's fake news and what's just a false story, what's a misunderstanding. But what they've done so far is they've taken a step whereby they are no longer allowing identified fake news sites to advertise on their networks. The deeper issue would be to address the way an algorithm like Facebook's actually seems to prioritize fake news. I mean, the algorithm is geared toward what gets clicks, what gets likes, and that lends itself to sensationalism. So what Facebook will have to do is find probably an algorithmic solution if it really wants to tackle this and to make truth a value that it optimizes for, along with all the other things it optimizes for in the newsfeed algorithm.
Of course, though, these are all businesses, Facebook and the other, they're businesses. Won't they be losing money if they do that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, Facebook, if you ask them what the goal of their newsfeed is, the goal is to show users what they want to see. And in fact, when they train their newsfeed ranking algorithm, their optimal outcome is they go and ask a Facebook user, out of all the stories we could have shown you at the top of your feed, which ones would you have liked to see first? And then that's what they test their algorithm against. So they are there to please their users. Now, if it turns out that their users love reading stories that confirm their political mm-hmm. viewpoint, whether or not they're true, that presents a little bit of a conflict for Facebook, because then you have the option to either keep pleasing people by feeding them fake and misleading stories, or to try to fulfill some sort of democratic obligation to inform the public or to challenge people's viewpoints. It's not clear that it's in their interest to do that.
But are they going to go in that direction for now? Are they going to try to limit the fake news? And can they do it? You mentioned the algorithms. Is it actually possible to do that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think the underlying story here is really a conflict over what Facebook is as a company. So Facebook considers itself a technology company. It has built software tools that allow people to connect with each other. But if you ask a lot of the people in the media, politicians, Facebook has become a dominant force in the news industry. And they see Facebook as refusing to own up to the roles that a media company usually plays, which are to inform and to educate and not just to connect people regardless of what the content is. So I think that Facebook will respond to that pressure. There are already signs that they feel it. They do not want to be perceived as a bad company. And even as CEO Mark Zuckerberg has been denying that this is really a problem, there are reports that there are internal groups of Facebook employees who are meeting in secret to figure out what they can do and how they can pressure him to.
Could they just take the ads off of the phony news stories, and there's no money to be made on that?
Yeah, that's part of it. And then that just leaves the much deeper problem of the fact that Facebook's entire algorithm is structured to show people what they already want to see, as opposed to expose them to different points of view.
So we'll see how this all plays out in the future. This is the future.
It's here.
It is pretty hard. Thank you, Will.
Thanks.
Will Arima, senior technology writer for Slate. We're going to take a break. When we come back, it's the cold show. I don't mean the show itself. But we're dedicating the rest of the hour to that perennial enemy, the common cold, how you get it, the science behind it, do the cold remedies work? Just in time for that holiday season, I think you'll learn a little bit about spending time with other people. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Know thyself, know thy enemy. You might be familiar with that line from Sun Tzu's The Art of War, but it's not exclusive to the battlefield. It could refer to a political opponent or an opposing sports team or a cold. That's right, this hour we're getting to know the enemy within, the common cold, starting with where does it come from? Does it have any weaknesses? How does it spread? Will we ever get our hands on that secret weapon, a cold vaccine? That's what we're going to be talking about. Lots of stuff. Our number, 844-724-8255. If you want to talk with us, 844-724-8255. Or you can tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guests. Fred Adler is professor of mathematics and biology at the University of Utah. Jeff Bender, professor of public health in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota, who joins us via Skype. Welcome, gentlemen, to Science Friday.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Fred, when we use the term common cold, it's really a catch-all for many different families of viruses, is it not?
That's correct. There's at least six families of viruses that cause common colds in people, and they're actually quite hard to tell apart from your own symptoms.
So you can't tell by what kind of, oh, I'm not going to get gross, your mucus is coming out or sneezing, which kind of cold virus you have.
In general, no. Usually the most severe things caused by influenza are distinguishable because you're so sick. But most of the other colds are fairly similar in the way they play out.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, what do we know about where these viruses come from?
You know, we often speculate that many of our novel viruses come from animals. Sorry, am I getting some feedback?
No, we hear you fine.
Sorry. We often speculate that many of these novel viruses come from animals, and many do. But I would also argue that many of these come from people and are actually well-adjusted in people. And so there seems to be this constant interchange historically, kind of shared microorganisms that we've had historically. However, we have seen this concern recently about some of these viruses jumping between animals and people.
Hmm. And how did they do that? Do we come in contact with them directly, or are there droppings? How does that happen?
Oftentimes it's with direct contact with the animals themselves. And thankfully, when you think about most of the cold viruses, you know, we think about rhinoviruses and adenoviruses and metapneumoviruses, and these ones are actually have what we call a high species barrier, and very difficult to jump. But basically, sometimes there is that time when it does jump, you know, high enough to get over that species barrier to allow for that interchange, and that might be through direct contact with the animal itself.
Mm-hmm. Fred, what is it about the rhinovirus, and rhino means nose, right, that
yes.
makes it so well adapted to humans?
I think there's a few things. One, as Jeff just said, it's perfectly human specialized, so it's good at its job because it mainly does one thing. Another is that it seems that it's evolved from viruses, enteroviruses that live in our gut, and it pops up periodically, loses its ability to survive in your gut, and then takes over your nose and transmits itself there. And third, there's this huge diversity of them, at least 150 types of it. So you have a long life to look forward to getting fresh, new rhinoviruses.
But does that mean, you know, this is a question we get asked and I've asked all the time. I've had, you know, a family of kids. If I get a cold and my kid gets the cold and I get over the cold, am I immune to the cold I just gave to the kid?
It depends. So rhinovirus seems to be unusual in that you get some degree of immunity, but not perfect immunity. Influenza, as a much more severe disease, tends to give perfect immunity for the rest of your life. So rhinovirus immunity, for reasons that are not fully understood, fades over time. And so not only are there 150 different rhinoviruses you can get over the course of your life, but you can get them more than once.
And so is that the total number of viruses, or are there the subsets of these viruses and other subsets that go on and on?
It's hard to know exactly how many there are. People have now taken to characterizing them by genetic sequencing, and once again, they characterize about 150 rhinoviruses. I don't think there are that many others, to tell you mm-hmm. the truth. And then there's roughly 50 other virus types in these other families that can also cause these colds that are so hard to tell apart.
Is that one of the problems in developing a vaccine for a cold virus? There are so many of viruses?
Yes, that's right. So there's been some exciting new trials just came out this year on a vaccine, and they managed to pack 50 different types into one vaccine and showed a good response, at least in mice and in rhesus macaques. And so it is possible that somebody could load up a vaccine with a lot of these different common colds and induce pretty effective immunity.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Bender, is it possible to trace back in history when viruses started spreading from animals into humans?
Yeah, I think for some of these, we're getting the tools to better detect, you know, when we see the divergence or change over time. You know, some of these viruses are quite older. Actually, some are actually quite new. I think a good example of one that manifests itself with some common cold system is the metapneumovirus. And I think it's speculated that it probably in the last couple hundred years, that transmission probably from birds to humans occurred. But again, I think that we have a lot to learn here still regarding when and how often these interchanges occur.
Donna Henderson tweets in, wants to know, why is it called a cold? When you think about it, where did that start?
I mean, traditionally, it's because they're associated with winter. And so people assume that cold caused colds. And rhinovirus itself is not that actually tightly associated with the winter season. People get rhinoviruses all year. We just think of them differently in the summer, and they're maybe more annoying because you're not supposed to get colds in the summer. But once again, there's some other recent really exciting data showing that the tissues in our bodies and our noses that are not quite as warm as the rest of our body are more susceptible to getting infected. And so maybe there is a real association between cooler temperatures and being susceptible to getting infected by colds.
Yeah, I remember we had a story on years ago where we found out that even just having a warmer climate. I mean, so I remember the numbers was something like 93 degrees and 86% humidity or something like that, that the viruses don't survive well in that kind of heat and humidity. Any truth to that?
I'm not certain about that. It seems to vary a lot from virus to virus, what sort of external conditions they can tolerate. Mm-hmm. So this new work is more about how our cells that have to spend a lot of their time fighting off viruses are less capable of doing that when they're slightly chilled.
That's because their immunity, our body's immunity is down a little bit when we get cold?
Exactly. Yeah, the functions of cells like interferon that you've probably heard about are reduced when those cells are not at typical body temperature.
I like that. It explains a lot. So, Jeff, a lot of people want to know, can you give your cold to your pet or vice versa?
That's a good question. I think Fred really has done a good job to say that many of these viruses that we associate with colds are really species-specific and really well adapted to people for the most part. And so the ones that we've been talking about, specifically rhinovirus or adenovirus, these really are human-specific. And so the chance that we can get something or give something to our pet is pretty unlikely. In fact, the opposite sometimes happens, is that we've given some things to our pets. And I think probably most recently we've seen this discussion about influenza, especially when we had the pandemic of 2009, there were a number of reported cases of basically pets actually picking up influenza from their probably sick caretakers or sick human caretakers.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Minneapolis to Wes. Hi, Wes. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
My question was, if you were to, let's say, live in a remote island in the Pacific, would you get a cold, or would somebody else have to show up there to spread a virus to you?
Somebody else would have to show up. So there's various anecdotes from the Antarctic, like the Shackleton expedition. Those guys did not get colds because they were so isolated that their population wasn't large enough to support colds at all. And there's other more recent studies from the British Antarctic Survey showing that they became actually increasingly susceptible to getting colds because they went for months or years without being exposed.
Well, what if a bird show up and bring the cold to you?
As Jeff pointed out, most of these colds couldn't come from a bird. So I guess if you're unlucky and an avian influenza showed up, that would be a disaster on your remote island.
Mm-hmm. Are there diseases, Jeff, that we do need to worry about possibly getting from our pets?
For the most part, no. Simple things that we do can put us at risk. And this gets into some basic hygiene things, which is good to remember even for the common cold. And that gets into good hand hygiene. The other thing I often tell folks is probably not a good idea to let your pet lick your face or to lick them, and basically potentially share things that they might have, and more of some of the enteric bacteria or other things that I'm more worried about in transmission versus probably a cold virus or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Can dogs get the flu, things like that?
They do. In fact, in the past year, there's been a fairly substantial outbreak of canine influenza, so there are specific strains that we see in dogs. The good news is that we haven't seen that particular strain manifested in people. But it's a good idea that we watch for these viruses because we know that sometimes they're sloppy in their replication, and there are potential opportunities for interchange of those viruses between animals and people.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the most misunderstood thing about, I'll ask both of you, about catching or keeping or getting rid of a cold is? What?
Hard to say.
Is it so? Because there's so many misunderstood things, you can't narrow it down?
I mean, I guess one of the things I think of is people who claim that they've never had a cold in their life. And it seems extremely unlikely there's anyone who's never had a cold. There may be people for whom the symptoms are so mild they don't notice them. And there are many undiagnosed or undetectable viral infections in people. But the idea that I'm 93 and I've never had a cold, I think, is pretty much impossible.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt your...
That's it. That was my main misconception I can think of. I mean, there's all the stuff about the various folk remedies, but I'm not expert in whether or not some of those, in fact, work.
We're going to get into that a little bit later in the program. Here's a tweet that came in. It said, from Tweedledee says, I heard that cold viruses mutate their coats so fast that they can duck the immune system and reinfect. Is that true?
They mutate very quickly, but not so fast as to reinfect. Viruses, and most of the viruses we've been talking about, have extremely high mutation rates, like 10 or 100,000 times faster than us. So they're very poorly built in general, but even that is not enough for them to completely change their shape. The way that the most dangerous influenza pandemics have emerged is through changing their external coats, but that's something that we see happening only every 2 or 3 years.
Mm. Let's go to Lindsay in Lubbock, Texas. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. My question is, I'd always heard that we get a cold in the winter because we tend to be indoors near other people more than in the summer where we're all walking around outside. Is that true?
I would say yes, that one of the primary factors in triggering the spread of colds and other infectious diseases is kids going back to school. And that does do exactly what you say, concentrate them indoors. The other factor that does seem to have some support is vitamin D, that if we spend less time outdoors, we get less vitamin D from the sun, and vitamin D is important in keeping your immune system active.
Hmm. And the idea that it's cold out and that lowers our immunity, perhaps, or to a virus attack, does that hold any water?
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know. As far as I can tell, the evidence is difficult to obtain because these viruses are so hard to study outside of the body. But I think that element, that is, the viruses survive better outside of the body, and what we were talking about before, mm-hmm. the chilled tissues are more susceptible, are all components of this.
So when your mom told you to wear a jacket and bundle up warm, she was right.
Hmm. Yeah, pretty much.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Fred Adler and Jeff Bender about the common cold, trying to get to as many myths and whatever. Why you mentioned it was so hard to study viruses. Why is it so hard to study them?
They're very small, so they're hard to see. And it's hard to study them. I mean, genetic methods have made it much easier to study them now. So a lot of the recent studies can just take swabs out of people's noses and see what viruses are in there. But to figure out what they're actually doing is much more difficult, and you really have to follow people over time. And to study transmission is very hard because it's tiny numbers of viruses that are involved, and figuring out exactly where they came from. Were they sitting on a table, floating around in the air, on your dog? It's just hard to trace them back.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, is it likely we could see a new virus spread from animals into humans today?
Yes, actually, just to build on Fred's comment too about why some of this is so difficult to study, the mere fact that there might be well over 200 different viruses that are associated with the common cold makes it difficult. And is it just one, or is it actually many of them working in concert as well? Do we have kind of multiple infections or multiple viruses causing infections as well? And so I think that when we think about this, we're starting to get the tools, but frankly, we just don't really understand, in a sense, the microbiome and its relationship to how these viruses actually grow and persist as well. So it really highlights that complex system.
Yeah, you've touched on our favorite subject, the microbiome. You just threw that in because you knew we'd like. So getting back to my question about is it likely we could see a new virus spread from animals into humans today?
The answer is yes, and I think that we've been seeing that, especially lately. There's been a number of recent events that have highlighted some basically opportunistic viruses that have changed and mutated. And I think some specific ones are something like severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, if you recall, mm-hmm. or even currently the Middle East respiratory syndrome, coronavirus. So both of these are coronaviruses. They have an animal host. And so those are good examples of where we've seen that spill over occasionally from animals to humans.
Mm-hmm. Question that we've all wondered about, a tweet from Gene Landerville says, what about feed a fever, starve a cold, or is it the other way around?
I don't know what the answer is. My philosophy is, if you're hungry, you should eat.
That means you're healthy. You're feeling better.
Exactly. If you feel good enough to eat, go for it. And I do believe in chicken soup.
I only have about a minute or so left with you guys. Anything that we left out that you get asked all the time about colds and you'd like to know?
And mainly it's about what we were talking about before in terms of, will there be a treatment?
Yeah.
Will there be a cure? How do they get transmitted?
I'll ask the ultimate question. Will we ever have a vaccine for the common cold? For one vaccine, or never going to happen?
I think there will be a vaccine, and there will be a question of whether we use it or not. And it may not seem worth it to people, given that colds aren't that severe for most individuals.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good way to wrap it up. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us. Fred Adler, professor of math and biology at the University of Utah. Jeff Bender, professor of public health in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Thank you, and happy holiday to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Up next, we explore which cold treatments are backed up by science and answer your questions about them. We'll get to all those things, from zinc to vitamin C to, chicken soup. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Stay warm. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the common cold this hour. It is a perennial invader, which means we're given plenty of chances to either put up a fight or decide we're just going to surrender to the sniffles. So what have years of battling the cold virus taught us about how to tackle it? Producer Katie Heiler asked people out here on the streets of New York what they do when they go toe-to-toe with the common cold.
We take something natural, you know, like ginger with, you know, lime, and we just drink something, like a tea.
Ginger tea, a little bit of honey.
I drink a lot of tea. I drink a whole lot of emergency and airborne.
I'll tell you what I don't believe in, emergency. I think that stuff is...
I do believe in emergency. I think that's more crap. Preventative when I'm starting to feel it a little bit.
Emergency is absolute nonsense.
Chug a ton of water all day and try to get a good night's sleep.
Eat some soup. That's like chicken soup.
Save the baby with a dirty sock around your throat.
Is Save the Baby like Vicks VapoRub?
Yes.
Now?
Yes, okay. It is.
Why a dirty sock?
I don't know.
I generally ignore it and pretend it's not happening.
Does that mean you continue to like drink and all that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nothing will stop me from drinking, to be quite honest with you.
What about you?
Lots of water. Zinc lozenges. I know everyone, that's probably the popular thing. And I... No? You don't have that in England?
I've never even heard of a zinc lozenge. I don't even know what that is.
I normally take a lot of vitamin C tablets and a lot of juice. And I normally get flu shot.
Actually, I gargle salt water, and I wash hands a lot, and vitamin C, load up on that.
Sounds pretty familiar, right? Especially, I don't know, that dirty sock. I don't think I've ever heard of that one. But is there any hard evidence to back them up, some of these common cold remedies? And how can you tell if the cold you're at war with, or is it something else that's infecting you? Well, maybe it's the flu, or is it allergies? Well, if you want answers, we've got some of them. Joining me now to talk about it is Akiko Iwasaki, professor of immunobiology at Yale Medical School. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ira.
Diane Pappas is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Virginia. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's go right to it, Dr. Iwasaki. When we catch a cold, it always seems to start in your nose. Why is that?
So the common cold virus that causes the cold is actually called the rhinovirus. And the name comes from the fact that the virus replicates in the nose first. So the virus starts to grow inside the lining of the nose, and that is probably why we feel the symptoms first starting in the nose.
And then it spreads to the rest of your body?
So in healthy people, the virus stays in the nose and does not spread to other places. But people with asthma and other respiratory conditions, the virus can spread from the nose to the lung, and that's where the mucus secretion that is induced by this virus causes the block in the airway. Depending on the host, it can go from the nose, it can stay there, or it can spread.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pappas, how long? I've always wondered about this. You know, you see people who are starting a cold, right? You know, they got the first symptoms. How long after you come down with the cold are you infectious to other people?
Well, once you get inoculated with the cold virus, it doesn't take very long before you start to have symptoms. And on days 2 and 3, you're much more likely, you're really able to spread that cold very, very easily to other people. So you're most infectious on the 2nd and the 3rd day of the cold infection.
And how long should the cold last in your body before it turns into something else like a secondary infection? How do you know it's just a cold?
Well, colds in adults are going to last about 5 to 7 days, and then they're going to be gone. In children, a normal, uncomplicated cold can go from 10 to 14 days. And so we really don't start calling it a secondary infection until we've kind of passed that 10 to 14-day mark in kids, if we're talking about a sinus infection. There's some other things kids can get, like ear infections, which are extremely common, often during the first week of a cold. So for younger kids under the age of 5, probably over half of them will get an ear infection or can get an ear infection with a cold virus. In adults with sinusitis, I would think it would be after the 5 to 7 days the cold has run its course.
Do kids present themselves differently than adults with symptoms?
Kids are different than adults. So younger children tend to have fever at the beginning of their cold, whereas adults tend not to have fever. The symptoms, like we said, in children tend to last longer than it does in adults. Kids are much more likely to be symptomatic. There are adults, and kids can do it too, but in adults particularly, you can be asymptomatic, although you are infected, and you won't know that you're infected. Kids, if they're infected, they are much more likely to be symptomatic with their colds. They're much more likely to have complications like ear infections, and then there are certain presentations that are specific to kids because of their airway. things like croup or things like bronchiolitis that happen in our younger kids.
Dr. Iwasaki, we have always have a big debate in our Science Friday office. How do you know if it's a cold, a sinus infection, or some allergy that's going around?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sometimes these symptoms are difficult to tell apart. But a cold is, just to clarify, the cold is caused by a virus. An allergy is caused by an allergen, which is not an infectious material. It's an irritant. And sinus infection is caused most often by bacteria. So a good sign of bacterial infection is that the mucus turns green or yellow. It's kind of gross, but so where a cold infection produces mucus that's clear and watery. An allergy often produces symptoms that are similar to cold. So the mucus is watery and clear. But the allergy is dependent on the exposure to the allergens. So if you change the environment, for example, you go from the indoor to the outdoor or go from one building to another and you see that your symptoms improve, it is likely a sign of an allergy instead of a cold.
So many questions from listeners. Let's see if we can get a few of them in. Let's go to the phones to Evan in New York. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
As a new public school music teacher, I see about 800 kids a week. I get sick all the time. My first year teaching, what can I do to get over these colds and not take so many days off?
800 kids. You're both blanching at the thought.
It's a lot. The best thing you can do is prevention, right? If once you get the cold, we're really pretty much stuck. So if you can do your hand washing, soap and water is the best thing you can do. Get your flu vaccine so that you don't get influenza and reduce your stress. We know that increased stress, at least there's one study that says that'll increase your rates of infection. Don't smoke because smoking increases your susceptibility to colds. But really it's soap and water and keeping your hands out of your eyes and your nose.
Well, let's talk about that, how the cold is spread. Is it really spread surface to surface, hand to hand? You touch something, they touch something, you shake hands, or are you sneezed on or coughed on?
I think the studies really tell us. Go ahead.
Sorry. I think the virus can spread in both ways, but a vast majority of the transmission between humans is thought to be by touching the surface or shaking hands or touching the doorknobs. And sometimes it can be spread by coughing and sneezing as well.
Mm-hmm. So wash those hands. You say you just need to wash your hands with soap and water. You do not need to use the hand cleaner.
The hand cleaner actually may not get everything, so soap and water is your best bet.
And do you have to wash your hands a certain amount of time? Was it sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, something like that?
I don't know an exact amount of time.
Okay, let's go. A lot of questions on the phone. Let's go back to the phones to Adrian in St. Paul. Hi, Adrian.
Hi.
Hey there. Go ahead.
So I've read articles before that talk about how kids who pick their noses and eat their boogers, like, it might actually help their immunity. So along that same vein, if a person who has a cold ingests like their own mucus, is that potentially helpful, or does it perpetuate a cold more?
I don't know of any evidence of eating boogers being helpful. In a similar way, when you have a cold, you're likely swallowing a lot of that virus that is discharged from the nasal cavity anyway. I don't think there's any need to actively swallow the cold virus in order to immunize yourself. And again, I don't know of any evidence that swallowing or eating cold virus will help.
Mm-hmm. Are you then reinfecting yourself every time you swallow your own mucus? Is it perpetuating the cold to keep going?
I don't think so. I mean, once you get the cold, you know, the virus takes its course and it's cleared by the immune system. So, I'm not sure if there's anything actively you can do to promote faster clearance, other than to say that getting enough sleep and, being stress-free is very important.
Yeah, easy to do these days, right? Let's go to Sarah in Somerville, Mass. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. My question is about zinc lozenges. I've had terrific luck using zinc lozenges both to shorten the life of a cold, but especially when I feel one coming on, and I've even sometimes taken them just if I'm on an airplane or feel like I might be getting exposed. I was wondering about the science behind that and also any risks associated with consuming zinc.
All right, good question. Let's get into those home remedies. Does zinc
work? The studies on zinc in adults suggest that they could shorten the duration of cold symptoms. The studies in children are not supportive, and side effects are common, so bad taste and nausea tend to go with zinc. But we really don't have large, high-quality trials that can let us make clinical recommendations that zinc is the way to go. We just don't have that information.
We had a man on the street, a little vox populi before we started here, people telling of their home remedies. Let's go through some of them. What about high doses of vitamin C? I was at Linus Pauling who used to champion that years ago.
Vitamin C is in the same boat with zinc. There are some studies that suggest that it may reduce the duration of the cold. But then some further studies with therapeutic trials did not show the same effect, so we just don't have the information to say that vitamin C is effective and can't really recommend it at this point.
Chicken soup,
there's a study. So if you sip hot chicken soup, you can increase the flow of nasal mucus. So whether that's a benefit or not, that's probably personal preference, but it does do something.
Mm-hmm. So at least makes you feel a little better, right?
Yeah. Now the effects are gone within 30 minutes, but chicken soup is definitely different than sipping hot water. The chicken soup works better if you want to make your nose run.
Do you know of any connection between the microbiome in our gut and getting a cold? Do we know yet? Because it's a relatively new science.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a study that specifically looks at that, but studies from a model of flu infection, for example, indicate that the commensal bacteria are important to maintain the immune status of the host. So the bacterial product actually triggers signals in white blood cells that then promote protection when you're infected with flu. So there's probably a beneficial impact of the microbiome.
A tweet from a Life of Health asking about echinacea.
We have no evidence that echinacea is useful.
Where do you think all these things come from, all these home remedies ideas?
Because we all get the cold. We're all looking for something that will work.
Yeah.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Drs. Diane Pappas and Akiko Iwasaki about right now we've moved into how to cure the common cold with some of these other home remedies, and do they work or not? Let's go to the phones again. Let's go to Tom in Philadelphia. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ira. I love your show.
Thanks
for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I've read where it's possible to block off the flow of air to a nasal passage to try and make the environment more hazardous for virus. Is there any credence to that?
Blocking off how do you breathe if you're blocking off the flow?
Well, you block off your nose and breathe through your mouth.
Uh-huh. I don't think these doctors have heard these questions.
That's a new one.
Sorry.
Well, interesting.
What about that one that we heard where somebody said wear an old dirty sock around your neck? Have you heard of that one?
Not recently.
Maybe that just keeps people away from you. So
yeah, probably. there is. I don't know about blocking air to the nose, whether that's effective, but warming the nasal temperature inside is probably beneficial. Studies from our laboratories have shown that higher temperature promotes resistance to cold virus. So, you know, if you can keep your nose warm, it's probably a good thing.
Is it because the virus can't multiply under that kind of condition?
That's correct. So even increasing the temperature from a nasal temperature that's normally there, which is about 33 degrees Celsius, to 37 degrees Celsius, which is what you find in the rest of the body, the virus can't replicate at that temperature. So it's probably a good idea to keep your nasal passage warm.
What about keeping your room warm then? I mean, I'm serious. If you raise the temperature and humidity of the rooms, and even though the virus is there and it's not going to replicate, especially in a doctor's office where everybody's sitting together, touching things and breathing on each other.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Humidity is very well known to block transmission of virus from one person to another. And of course, the higher the temperature, the higher the humidity. So it's probably a good idea to keep your room warm and humid.
Well, there's something positive we can do. let's go see if we get another phone call or two. This one in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Ori.
Hi, Ara. Thank you for taking my call today. I have a question for your panelists. What if you know for sure you already have a sinus infection? Is it possible to catch a cold on top of that days later?
Mm. Complications.
Yeah. I think you can always catch a cold.
Yeah. How hard is it for a doctor to diagnose that you have a cold? And it's not
any harder than you diagnosing a cold. I mean, we all know the symptoms. We've all lived through many, many colds. I'm ruling out allergies and kids. We rule out foreign bodies and those sorts of things, but they're different.
Mm-hmm. Any other hints, you know, for when now everybody's going to get together for the holiday season, what to do when we're all together?
Keep your hands clean and try not to sneeze on each other and keep the room warm and eat well and sleep well.
Easy for you to say. Okay. Thank you both. This has been highly educational. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us. Akiko Iwasaki is professor of immunology at Yale Medical School. Diane Pappas, professor of pediatrics at the University of Virginia. Thank you both, and happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays, Ira.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Harwitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York, without whom we wouldn't be here. If you'd like to, please send an email to scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.